child. It's time to juggle, it's too wild. That's why we got more than two styles. To adapt in the situation, too shy. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try the next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive. And it's time to be willing. Swimming through the waters above and not like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, critical and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fight from his lips. Burn a slave driver.
Welcome, listeners, to Time for an Awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, New Media for the New Millennia. This is a history and current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people will turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing, therefore get wisdom, so all thy getting get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to get involved in the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live audio at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream. At that location, you can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live audio playing there. You can go to abibitumi.com. That's abibitumi.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live audio there. They stream from Ghana. Or you can download the TuneIn Radio app to any of your devices. TuneIn Radio is a free radio app. In the TuneIn search engines, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon, and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you had a Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, it's Time for an Awakening radio program with a live stream of the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for an Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, you can type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you always see interesting content being posted daily by myself or Brother Richard. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for an Awakening media is also there. Always full of the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening, interesting articles that you can read, download at later times, and share with your friends. Also, check out that Time for an Awakening marketplace and our partnership with the Abibitumi. Always interesting things in the marketplace all the time. Various African language classes, classes on education, economics, social systems, health, and much, much more being taught by professors on both the continent and in the diaspora. So, again, make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. It's 7:06 here on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening, this Sunday, March 10th edition of Time for an Awakening. Our guest this evening in conversation will be several student organizers from several different universities across the country. And also joining us in conversation later on in the program will be activist, organizer, and journalist and playwright, the U.S. correspondent to the Herald, which is Zimbabwe's national newspaper, Brother Obi Igbona Jr. With the wars raging in the Middle East and on the African continent and the death toll rising daily, we will hear from these young activists about their collective fight against oppression, racism, Zionism, and colonialism. We'll be right back to get the program started after a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening with your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. for podcasting or live program scheduling. Hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. Before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-host, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum here in Philadelphia at 7th and Arch Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm doing fine. I'm doing fine. I'm glad that this conversation is occurring because it gives us this opportunity, or at least it'll give me this opportunity to check in this moment of what does student activism mean when we're looking at anti-colonialism and, you know, the system of global white hegemony, and for them to give, you know, assist us in how are they viewing that. So this is an important moment, I think, for all of us.
You know, I aired on Monday, for the listeners that heard it, the teach-in that was hosted by Brother Obi Igbona Jr. and others, and the students were involved, and I knew that it was necessary to get them on this Sunday so that people can hear exactly what's going on in college campuses in relation to the wars on the African continent, the war in Gaza and the Middle East, and how all this relates to a struggle that we have had for decades, maybe hundreds of years, in this soil of North America. Before we do that, Richard and listening audience, you'll hear from three generations of people involved in this struggle. The first you'll hear from he was known at that time as Willie Ricks. He's known now as Mukasa Dada, one of the past guests on our program. He was involved and participated in organizing marches and sit-ins during the quote-unquote civil rights era and violent confrontations throughout the South. He was on the bridge in Selma. He was a field secretary and organizer for the Lowndes County Freedom Party, which became the Black Panther Party. And he also participated in the March Against Fear with James Meredith, Dr. King, Stokely Carmichael, who became Kwame Ture, and others. And that's where he first uttered the phrase Black Power. You're going to hear from him because I wanted to play the segment that he did in the teach-in on Monday for our listening audience to hear. I think it's important. Afterwards, you're going to hear from the students. Afterwards, you're going to hear from these students. Ethan Levine, Pan-African Student Union at Brown University. Adam Ganoum, the Muslim Student Association at the University of Maryland, and Mamadou Tal, the Coalition of Mutual Liberation at Cornell University. And then closing out things for us, you're going to hear from activist, organizer, journalist, and playwright Obi Igbona Jr. But before we get to all of our guests, I want to play for the listening audience the statements and comments made by Mukasa Dada, who was known at that time when he was an activist and student as Willie Ricks. Listen to what he said on Monday at the teaching that was aired on Time for an Awakening.
Greetings, brothers and sisters. I was around when the students at Cornell University took over the administration building with their rifles and guns and demand African studies and began and demand that they learn about the struggle of our people. And that's how you got to African studies, Black Student Unions at Cornell University. Secondly, I was in an organization, SENCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and part of all the civil rights organizations that existed at that time, especially nationally or whatever they called themselves, and at SNCC, we fought the country, we fought the government, and at one point we had to pick up weapons and defend ourselves just like Hamas and the rest of them. At another point, we demand that we have a voice. We tried to do it through voting and what have you, and they bombed us, they killed us, and what have you. And at another point, when one of our young SNCC workers, Sammy Young Jr., who had been in the Navy, went into a bathroom that said white only, when he came out, they shot him in the head with a shotgun. At that point, SNCC, Kwame, H. Ralph Brown, Julian Bond, John Lewis at that point. No, John was gone. But we, when the Zionists attacked Egypt, we spoke out for Egypt. And we spoke out against Zionism. We spoke out against Israel and said the land belonged to the Palestinians. And therefore, we fully support Palestine. And we fully, with all our might, join in the fight against Zionism. And we join in the fight against the spoke up about Zionism. SNCC at that point had a probably $1 million budget or even more. But we spoke up against Zionism. They did everything psychologically and to cut our money off, physically cut our money off, and basically run SNCC out of business. We were attacked by the Zionists. But that inspired us and encouraged us to join in with the Palestinians, get more information on Palestine, get more information on Zionism. And today, we know that Zionism is backed by the United States. We know that Biden, we know that the United States is top gun in Palestine. Their bombs, their guns, their poison, and their techniques are the ones that's committing genocide on the Palestinian people. We know that all the European nations in NATO, all of them have settler colonists, all of them have committed genocide, and the same genocide you see in Palestine, all of them have blood on their hands for people all over the world. You could talk about the native people in the Americas, hundreds of millions. You could talk about the slave trade, hundreds of millions. You could talk about Africa itself, the land Africa is being plundered, is being raped for the richness, diamonds, gold, all of this. And the people of Africa, most of them don't know what a bathroom is, never seen a clean drop of water, and continue to be exploited by the United States and by all the multinational corporations and all these colonials and settler colonials and imperialism. They continue to rape Africa, and now we must take action against them. All the students in the universities, you should go and shut down the administration building. You should march on the campus every day. You should picket on the campus every day. You should have freedom school all over the campus and the community. Go to the churches and tell the people about Zionism. Tell them what Zionism is. Let them know that the Democratic Party, Republican Party, are all in the bed with Zionism, and Zionism is raping our motherland, Africa. The Zionists are training all these police techniques to choke us to death, kill us, murder us, and do all of that, and we must fight Zionism, and we must burn these jails and prisons down, just like the brothers in Haiti just did today. Zionism is part of what's going on in Haiti, but they're worldwide, and we must join in. And I'm very happy to know, to say that at the same time we fought with Palestine, we fought with the Vietnamese people against imperialism, we fought with Angola, Mozambique, Zimbabwe, Guinea-Bissau, South Africa, and Angola, and many, many other nations around the world. We played a role in helping the nations in the Caribbean rise up against imperialism. We joined and took the great leadership of Ho Chi Minh and Fidel Castro and Mao and many, many others. And we thank Russia for playing the role that they have played in training and organizing and giving the people basically needs that they need, like toothpaste, water, and many, many other things, the roles that Russia has played. And we know that the real enemy and the real warmonger, it's the United States, NATO, and the puppet United Nations. And nobody gonna speak up for us but us. Let us disrupt everything. I want 1,000,000 demonstrations all over this country. Every day we should protest, block roads, block streets, but demand. And we got to fight. We just can't talk about it. We got to go out and fight, and fight just like the Palestinians are doing. They have bought the fight out of us. We are fighting for our lives. And many of us, all of us right here in this land, we one day may have to die and give our life like the Palestinians are giving their life to save the rest of the Palestinians and to save the rest of the Africans in the world. And in order for us to save our people, we must be willing to bloodshed. We must be willing to bring a halt to this nation and to imperialism any way that we can. So again, I want to thank you very much. I thank little Ty brother and my little Palestinian brother, and thank all of you that's on this program today. And I'm just very honored to be in this crowd and to be with you. And I just come here to learn from you. But one thing we must do, we must organize. We must take action. Every day we must have some kind of action. And we must not assume that people understand Zionism, understand what them so-called Jews are doing. We must go and teach them ABC. Go to the churches and teach them. They had many, many people preaching to them that they are the Holy Land. They are God's children. No, they're the children of imperialism. They're the children of slavery. They're the children of genocide. And we must fight them until we wipe them out. And I'm proud to say, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free.
We'll be free.
Thank you, Africans. Thank you, everybody. Black power.
Richard, that was Mukasa Dada and his address before the students on Monday. Tonight, joining us are some of the students that participated in the teaching on Monday. Ethan Levine of the Pan-African Student Union at Brown University. Adam Ganoum, the Muslim Student Association at the University of Maryland. And Mamadou Tal, the Coalition of Mutual Liberation at Cornell University. I think Mamadou is with us, but we'll find out. Let's first go to Ethan. I'm sorry. Ethan, how are you, sir?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm glad to have you with us on the program tonight. Time for an awakening with myself and Brother Richard.
How you doing, brother?
I'm doing well. How you doing?
Ethan, listen, let's talk about what's going on Brown University, because I know that what's going on at Brown is going on at University of Maryland, is going on at Cornell. But talk about your efforts there with the Pan-African Student Union and rallying students around this issue of Gaza and this war against Israel. Give our listening audience a little background of what's going on the campus.
Yeah, no, I would say Brown's a little bit different than Cornell at University of Maryland in the way that it's somewhat notorious, although fabricated. It's notorious for being a community of progressivism, of social justice, has a history of activism. It calls itself sort of like a leftist space. And so they try their best to remain face in these facts and to be tolerant of some sort of student resistance, as long as it doesn't get too far into actually challenging the endowment, challenging the corporation's bottom line. In challenging exactly what they are as an institution and the puzzle piece they play in U.S. empire. And so they've let us have demonstrations. We've had two sit-ins now. I was a part of the second one. Both groups were arrested. We're still facing charges for that and disciplinary action on campus. We had a hunger strike, in which many of my friends were involved, and they didn't eat for 8 days. And again, we had a list of demands, which was just that they review this. We had this list called ACRIP, in which I think about 4 or 5 or 6 years ago, Brown Corporation was like, people were upset about some other investments that had taken place, and the student body and administration wanted to see these investments publicly and wanted to make sure that they were all socially responsible. And so that turned into ACRIP, which then became ACRUM. Don't really know the acronyms or whatever. And so there was a list of like 10 companies, one of them being like Textron, I think Raytheon, a couple more that were like directly weapon manufacturing, and other ones that are maybe like consumer goods that had indirect investments. And so the fight went beyond just to getting our school to divest. The fight went to radicalizing everybody around us. But the most material demand we could have was having our university divest. And so we presented them this list, and their arguments most of the time were just that it didn't define an explicit social harm. The report wasn't done well enough. Just a ton of excuses because they had the veto power at the end of the day. There weren't any like mechanisms of accountability involved. And they also maintained that they wanted to remain politically neutral. They didn't want to get involved on a political issue. And our argument of that was being invested in a genocide and an apartheid state, in a settler colony, that's not a neutral stance. Not being invested at all would be a neutral stance. And still, that doesn't absolve them from their responsibility in U.S. empire, but that's bare minimum. And so, yeah, they had us arrested, didn't even have a conversation with us. And all while portraying this neutrality, they've had Zionist speakers come on campus and perform indoctrination. They've had Jonathan Greenblatt, I believe is his name, of the Anti-Defamation League CEO, has been a racist publicly for a long time, a Zionist publicly for a long time. And so it's clear they're doing their best to maintain this reputation, this facade of social justice that doesn't actually threaten the foundation of these institutions. And that's all that's going on campus. Nothing too crazy. I know at Cornell, they've got the police involved. They've got real threats. Their Zionist front is a little bit more repressive or active in their repression. But that's what we're facing over here at Brown. But still no improvement so far.
You know, before I go to Adam and to Brother Mamadou, let me add, and I know Richard probably wants to ask you a few things too. But talk about what made you start getting active, Ethan. Were you kind of conscious of a lot of things before you got to Brown? Did you start really getting familiar with things after you got there? Were your parents kind of involved in kind of giving you background on things? I'm just curious because we've had a lot of activists and organizers on the program, and they all kind of reach an enlightenment or on the activism through different ways. And I'm just curious about you.
Yeah. No, I've had several periods of newfound radicalization. So there's a couple of different moments in which I built upon already having tried to make sense of the world in some ways and realizing that the world was anti-black, but then not yet having a class consciousness. These are things that came later, but definitely high school. I'm from Montgomery County. I went to Blake High School. So very predominantly black high school. And, you know, I didn't particularly think of myself as privileged, but I was extremely compared to my peers. Most of them not having fathers, some people homeless, some people coming to school hungry, all types of premature death, jail, everything. And I knew that wasn't normal. Meanwhile, a lot of my peers did. And so just questioning these things, and I've always been curious. And so just not normalizing these things, but really asking questions. My mom is from Burundi, a small country in East Africa. I take a visit there. Why are the black people in D.C. so poor? Why are we poor here? Why are we poor in Burundi? Just simple questions. And my parents weren't really the ones that gave me answers because they're a little bit apolitical, whatever. And so I had to go seek these answers out for myself. And I just came down the rabbit hole of more and more truth. Truth that felt like enriching. It started to alter my identity, a new sense of like pride. Started reading Malcolm X, all sorts of things. And then I had that probably going into Brown. It's probably what I wrote to get in here. And then again, radicalized further. I met Mamadou, who's on here as well. That's my mentor. Shout out Mamadou. And again, started to read Karl Marx, Lenin, really just get a whole deep historical context, and the analysis just kept going deeper. But you know, it's what motivates me to study. I don't even know that I would be in college if I wasn't studying material that was applicable to myself and to the people I love the most. And so, and Palestine as well. Learning about Palestine globalized my perspective further. I was already studying Africa, neocolonialism in Africa, but really understanding what it means to have Western hegemony and just how it shapes everything that exists in the world and impedes other countries from getting involved and even having a say in these global institutions like the UN, like the IMF, like the World Bank. And, you know, still just asking questions and making sense of all this. But that's sort of been the journey.
We're speaking right now with Adam Levine of the Pan-African Student Union at Brown University. Richard, I know you want to ask up before we go over to Adam. I know you probably want to ask a couple things to
Ethan. And I'll just ask one question so we, you know, and then we can have the dialogue. Ethan, I'm curious on relationship to other students as this radicalization is going on in Brown. How is this impacting, from your vantage point, you know, you mentioned about the city, you know, the hunger strike, the or the actions that are taking place. How are other students responding to this as these actions are taking place?
You know, I would like to think that some people have also taken this horrific circumstance as an opportunity to radicalize themselves further. But that also might be a biased position based on, you know, who I keep in my corner. And, you know, obviously I'm with people who are like-minded, but I know a lot of people also feel that it's not really their job to get involved. And so, you know, some people are really asking the tough questions and really recognizing the true nature of their institution and why it has to serve the corporation, the endowment, the bottom line, really actually being taken to task on their notions of being anti-capitalism. But a lot of other students, they feel, you know, that as long as this doesn't affect me materially, I can just have sympathy for the Palestinians. And that alone puts me on the right side of history. Obi has mentioned the same several times now that they don't need our sympathy. They need our solidarity and then camaraderie. So I definitely haven't seen enough of that at Brown. But that's also the expectation because, you know, we know these are exclusive, inaccessible institutions, and the type of people from the type of backgrounds which are coming in are not directly linked to struggle and suffering in the way some of us are. And so it's still an ongoing process, but yeah.
And I'll come back, Elliot, you know, later as we continue to open the discussion.
Okay, I'm going to go over to Adam Ganoon of the Muslim Student Association at the University of Maryland. Adam, can you hear me?
Yeah, you can hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yep.
Adam, talk about what's going on at the University of Maryland. We just heard from Ethan, and he kind of explained things at what's going on at Brown. Talk about your activism at University of Maryland and what has went on there, and even the backlash from the university itself.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I resonate with everything Ethan was saying. I think at the University of Maryland, it's a little bit different in terms of like the context. It started out like October 8th or 9th. There was an email that was sent to the entire campus about the events of October 7th. And there wasn't a single word or line mentioning any of the 75-year history of occupation, brutalization, ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian people, nothing. Not a single word was mentioned in that email. And in the coming weeks and weeks, and now it's been months and months since this genocide has been taking place, our administration has completely remained silent as to the 30,000 people that have been murdered in Palestine. So there's clearly a one-sided narrative going on. And when we've confronted the administration about it, they like to say that, oh, we want to focus on the present. We don't want to deal with historical things because there's so much history, they like to say. But then when prompted about the genocide that's happening, they say, oh, well, if we called for a ceasefire, we would get in a lot of trouble. And this is the biggest state school, the University of Maryland, College Park, the flagship state school in Maryland. And this is the type of repression they're facing from organizations such as the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League. And, you know, this is manifested in a lot of, what's it called, protests that happen, a lot of things such as chalking, facing a lot of restrictions. Like chalking is what, if we chalked at 8 p.m., 10 p.m. on the main plazas on campus, the following morning at 4 or 5 a.m., university facilities management trucks would come and power wash everything, right? And the night before at 8, 10 p.m. when we were doing it, people would call the cops on us multiple times, and they would call on motorcycles and, you know, with the body cams and say, what are y'all doing? And they would record every single piece of chalk. And even after verbally confirming that everything is within free speech policies, and nothing is violating our free speech, then it would still be power washed. So it just shows the level of oppression that's happening, the fear of opposing the status quo, the fear of jeopardizing their paychecks. The president of our university is the second highest public paid employee in the state of Maryland. He makes $800,000. All of our administrators who like to give us a lot of the DEI language, diversity, equity, inclusion language, about we want you to feel recognized, we want to support your voices, they get paid $300,000, $400,000 a year. They're making a lot of money, and they're content where they are. So We've also seen how Ethan talked a lot about divestment. We've pushed for divestment at our university, calling for transparency around the investments of the USM, this University System, Maryland Foundation, all the endowment being invested in companies. We don't know the exact amounts, but we have a lot of suspicions that it's military contractors that this money is going to. Even you look at the Board of Regents, it's all a bunch of corporate oligarchs. You have the chair of the Board of Regents is Linda R. Gooden. She's the former Lockheed Martin, former vice president of Lockheed Martin. You have a lot of corporate connections there and a lot of public relationships to engineering schools, pumping millions of dollars into the school and creating a lot of programs, a lot of feeder programs, like they call them, from graduating seniors in mechanical and aerospace engineering to go into these companies and make bombs and planes. So, you know, that's what we're pushing for, divestment. We're pushing for people to recognize what's happening, stay away from this one-sided narrative, understand the history, understand the context. But our biggest enemy is indifference, is that even though people may sympathize with the suffering of the Palestinians, they may see what's happening, they may like our Instagram posts, they are seldom to approach us and support us materially, support us in our demands. It's a hard reality that we face. But if it's any good news, it's that the past few months have seen an immense resurgence in support. And, you know, we've become the most well-known student organization on campus. That's all I got to say.
Adam, Ethan told us about some of the hunger strikes that had been done and the arrest that had followed. Is there any repercussions on your campus as far as the students getting involved and protesting in different ways?
We've been protesting like sit-ins of outdoor spaces, so it hasn't gone to the point where they have threatened to arrest us. We have not done a hunger strike. I commend the students of Brown for doing that. We have not done that. We have not actually been arrested yet. There have been in years past, is every year on our campus. There's actually an Israel festival held by the Zionists and pro-Zionist organizations on campus. And they celebrate the creation of State of Israel, which is exactly when the Nakba happened in Palestinian history, the ethnic cleansing of 600,000 Palestinians in their homeland in 1948. So in the past, Palestinian and Muslim students and their allies have gone and done a die-in where they would lay on the ground and basically carpet the area, simultaneously chanting and disrupting their event, where they would be chock full of cultural appropriation, full of claiming that falafel and these cultural foods are Israeli foods. And even in years past, they brought a camel for people to ride on to try and give it, purport that this is somehow authentically Israeli culture. So this is something that when the die-in happened, students were arrested. But that's the only instance of that happening.
A camel? Lord have mercy. A camel.
Richard, did you want to, or do you want to wait until we?
If I can just ask one, again, mm-hmm. or you can wait.
No, go ahead, because I'll go to Mamadou next. But go ahead,
Richard. I'll ask one that in relationship to Adam. I'm now curious as you and I'm, you know, you may have been taking on this kind of organizing activity before. Before you got to University of Maryland, but in taking on this organizing activity, I'm interested in two things. What have you learned in relationship to the Palestinian, Israeli, or Zionist conflict that you just didn't know that motivated you? And what have you learned about organizing actually on a college campus that you find is something that has something that you just helps you be able to continue to do this kind of work? And believe me, it ain't no easy work. What have you learned about Israeli Zionist thing in general? And it has to just be one point. And then as an organizer.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing learned about the Palestinian cause was because I guess I was introduced to my introduction to it was back in 2014, seeing the carpet bombing of Gaza. This is a previous iteration of what we're seeing now. Not as deadly, but still tragic. I think around 3,000 Palestinians were killed. But seeing that on the news and not being able to do anything about it, and you just see more and more people die in this horrific way, and they committed no crime. Seeing that like really pushed me to want to advocate. But then I guess growing up, you come into interaction with Zionists and the dialogue, and the entire argument is about ex-political party and ex-resistance movement. But the thing that I've learned is that we should never let them put us on the back foot, because at the end of the day, they are the occupiers. They are the ones who have been occupying the Palestinian people for 75 years, brutalizing them, and they are the cause of all of this. So any kind of vision for peace, any kind of vision for justice, any kind of authentic wanting of coexistence needs to understand that. So that's one thing that I've learned. And about organizing in general, I think the largest thing is that you just got to talk to people sometimes. You know, they have a lot of internalized, you know, biases, a lot of uncertainties, and they're not sure, but you need to talk with them and help them understand your pain. And then they can, you know, move forward and organize with you. Because if they don't understand your pain, they don't understand where you're coming from. Anyone can look at a fact sheet, but it seems like that in-person connection is what brings them to your cause.
Well, thank you.
Let's go over to Mamadou Tal, the Coalition of Mutual Liberation at Cornell University. I don't know whether Mamadou is here. Let's see. Mamadou, is this you?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Hear you loud and clear. This is Mamadou Tal.
Lovely.
Of the Coalition of Mutual Liberation at Cornell. Mamadou, you heard some of your colleagues at Ethan at Brown and Adam at GNU. Adam at University of Maryland. Talk about your activism going on at Cornell and you being a student there. Just give our listening audience some of the background on what's going on there at Cornell.
Absolutely. I think for context, it is important that I guess, expose to the audience the situation of Cornell, as in Benjamin Netanyahu's father was a professor here. And he laid a lot of the groundwork for Cornell and the links it has with Israel. So, for example, Cornell has a partnership with Israel through Technion, for example. So we are extremely heavily inundated with a Zionist presence on campus. So I guess in the immediate aftermath after October the 7th, what we did is we kind of knew that the backlash was going to be intense from Israel, but we also knew that they will try and pick off groups one by one. So immediately after October 7th, we created the Coalition for Mutual Liberation, which is a student umbrella, I guess, organization that houses over 40 students of color campuses. And in that, we realized that what is taking place in Israel doesn't just affect Palestinians, or what's taking place in Gaza rather doesn't just affect the Palestinians, but rather it also has an impact on what's going on in, let's say, Congo, for example. And what we realize is that we can't just speak in the name of one group because they'll pick us off easy, but rather we're constantly trying to find the interconnectedness of our struggles. And it has galvanized the campus in ways that I've heard senior faculty say the campus hasn't been galvanized like this since the Vietnam War. That's the kind of level we are talking about on campus in terms of engagement from students. And week in and week out, as we continue our disruptions, we are finding our numbers growing. We are finding that students are becoming less and less afraid about what has happened on campus. And we have a beautiful coalition, for example. We've had events that bring the struggles together of Congo, Sudan, and Israel, for example. And another one we have in teachings that talk about the connection between, for example, how is it that Israel is the fifth largest exporter of diamonds when there's no diamond mines in Israel? So we're seeing these connections through and through, which has been a source of, I guess, radicalization for so many students. But the administration has acted in super repressive ways. They have instituted and inaugurated a policy called the Interim Policy for Expressive Activity. And what they have said that outside of the hours of 12 to 1, no one can use amplified sound, megaphones, for example. They said at vigils, we can no longer use candles. And they have compared us to the tiki torch carriers who are neo-Nazis in the South. This is what they are calling the students, what admin is calling students. They have also said that we have to have this new policy because we don't want to, and I quote, have what the January 6th took place on Cornell campus, have a similar January 6th style takeover on campus. This is the language they're using against those who are pro-Palestinian. And it flies in the face of Cornell has a theme for every year. And this year, the theme for Cornell is freedom of expression. But quickly, we are seeing the hypocrisy of liberalism and the hypocrisy of the middle ground and neutrality and objectivity. Because what freedom of expression normally means, it means the freedom to be racist, or the freedom to be discriminatory, or the freedom to offend people. But when you say we are going to invoke that freedom to stand for justice or against genocide, we all too often find that, okay, maybe it's not freedom in that way. And we see once again that these institutions are not there to serve the aspirations of people of color. But I think, you know, in a funny way, this policy has united campus from the right to the left, because everyone values what should hopefully value freedom of speech and the freedom to protest. So what we're finding now is that faculty who maybe might not even be pro-Palestinian are now becoming, like, I guess, speaking out because of the gun. They might say we disagree with you, but we defend your right to say it. So it's been a very tough time, I guess, on Cornell's campus. We've had instances of the FBI turning up to campus. We've had Kamala Harris turn to campus to assure the safety of Jewish students on campus. We've seen the administration put out statements in which they don't mention Palestine at all. We've seen a disparity in treatment between those who are Jewish students and those who are Black, Brown, or Muslim students. So it's a very tense time on campus, but at the same time, it has been a galvanizing rallying call for so many students on campus.
Mamadou, go over that again. You said Kamala Harris is there for what reason, you said?
Kamala Harris's husband came to campus to reassure the safety of Jewish students on campus.
Mamadou, listen, let me ask you the source of that. Again, I didn't get a chance to ask Adam. I'll come back around to him when we kind of open things up. The source of your activism. Ethan said that he got into a lot of things when he started moving into higher education, so to speak. Mm-hmm. How about you? Were your parents kind of conscious of what was going on? Did they pass things down to you? Or were you exposed to a lot of things on the college campuses? Talk about the source of your activism.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think it's very difficult to kind of pinpoint, I guess, an exact moment. But what I can say, I mean, so my family is a political family. My great-grandfather was the first president of Gambia, and my family's always been in politics in the Gambia. But I guess, you know, if those who know the Gambian independence struggle, my great-grandfather was deeply conservative and deeply establishment. But then from my father's side were, you know, Pan-Africanists. They, you know, I heard the names of Nkrumah at dinner tables. I heard the names of Kwame Ture at dinner tables, Sekou Ture, Patrice Lumumba. So I kind of had an awareness of Pan-Africanism from my family, but also my family was very political growing up. I guess a turning point to, like, actually wanting to go into some kind of political activism, I guess it's going to be, I have to laugh at myself when I say this now, but it was Barack Obama. And I thought, oh, wow, you know, this is a Black guy that can do it. But then that's before I developed my, I guess, analysis of imperialism that came much later. I guess there's another turning point I can point to was reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. I guess that really inspired me and radicalized me and just took a lot of fear out of my heart and being vocal and being outspoken. And then as the journey goes on, I guess more and more increasingly reading about Pan-Africanism, reading about a material analysis, for example, reading about dialectical materialism, and now I'm now pursuing a PhD in which I look at state formation in the processes in the era of decolonization in West Africa. So it's all kind of been a journey. I still think it's ongoing. Process of radicalization, I don't think it ever stops. I think you just kind of deepen your knowledge. But I definitely think right now I put myself in the anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, pan-Africanist camp.
Richard.
You know, it's interesting. What struck me, Mamadou, that you mentioned was about the coalitions. And yeah. So I guess I wanted you to kind of go back over that in the sense of, is it Cornell? Is it the student population that comes to Cornell that you have these different interests that are willing to come together? Or is it the actual, the dialogue that, is it the Palestinian effort and the anti-colonization effort that you find these coalitions identifying with and realizing they have to work together? I'm interested in how do you see these coalitions coming together, why they came together?
I think why they came together, initially, it was a protection of students' organizations. We realized if we banded together, it would be much more harder for the administration to pick us off. But I guess more importantly and theoretically, it was literally the indigenous folks on campus came out and said, we recognize what this looks like. What's happening in Palestine, we recognize it. We have a history of settler colonialism against our people. It was other Black student unions and group recognizing, okay, how do we link in anti-imperialist struggles from, let's say, in the Congo and in Palestine and Gaza in this particular moment? So it was almost quite organic. It was through dialogue, through conversation, through study, through the various teaching that we increasingly kind of saw the link between all of our struggles.
Thank you. Ellie, you can go, open the discussion any further where you want to take it.
You know, I want to ask a question to all of our guests. And Mamadou, you kind of mentioned it when you said that Barack Obama was an inspiration to you until you started looking at what was really going on. I think I'm kind of paraphrasing what you stated. Yeah, am I right, Mamadou?
Yeah, that's correct. Well, that's definitely correct.
Now, let's, because I want to kind of pick your brain and Adam's brain and Ethan's brain. Because Ethan mentioned that Jonathan Greenblatt and his racist policies and upholding Zionism and other things, he came to Brown's campus to kind of, I guess, inspire and encourage Jewish students on campus. So let me ask all of you something. When you see, like, for example, Jonathan Greenblatt went on to a popular show, The Breakfast Club, and talked with young people there. And when I watched the interview. And when he says things that they can't challenge, when I say they can't challenge, they don't know enough to challenge it. And if they know enough, they're afraid to challenge it. When you see Kamala Harris and others going to these HBCUs and other college campuses, speaking directly to Black students or other students of color and spewing all this stuff that don't make sense. When you talk to your peers, your fellow students, and try to rebut some of these things, what is the response? Do they really understand what you're talking about? Do they kind of go into it for themselves, or they just kind of, it goes in one ear and out the other? I'm just curious to know the interaction with your peers when you see these things happening, and then you bring it home to them and discuss it. Now, I mean, whoever, Mamadou being that I'm talking to you, you can go first, and then I'll just go around.
Honestly, it's been quite like successful. I mean, we haven't had that much pushback other than, I guess, Zionist counter protesters, but we've had several teachings. We kind of adopt a policy in terms of organizing on campus that there should be no escalation without education. Okay. So any kind of event that we do in terms of protest, we accompany that with a teaching, teach people what is going on. And we have regular teachings in which we combat the kind of, I guess, most mentioned talking points of Zionists. The only thing I would say is an issue is I've had many young people say to me, students say to me, we agree this is a genocide, it's absolutely wrong, and we agree what you're doing on campus and we find it commendable. But however, we can't be involved because we have a career to think about. And that always, yeah, rubs me up the wrong way. That really does get to me because it's like you are admitting that some of the worst acts against humans are taking place. But and this is not even always to say things people can't do nothing. This is, I'm talking about student assemblies. So people who have decision-making power on campus, where they vote one way publicly because they want to save their image or quote-unquote their career, but behind closed doors they'll tell me privately that, oh, you know, we actually didn't want to vote publicly because we're afraid of how it looks. So it's been a mixed bag.
Ethan, how is it as far as your peers and relating to them when you see these things happening, like Greenblatt on a Breakfast Club and Harris and others on these campuses and saying things that really don't make sense? If the people start doing any cursory research, what they're saying doesn't make too much sense. But talk about it from your perspective. When you bring these things to your peers, what is the response?
Well, it depends what I'm talking to. I mean, at this point in my radicalization, most people I surround myself with are at least familiarized with the capitalist empire that is U.S. the America. So they aren't naive enough to actually fall under the belief that having a black president or black vice president actually does anything materially for black folks. But when I am around those people, it's like I give them grace because I know if I come at them just sort of explaining how naive and how oblivious they are and how by not recognizing the political implications of their own lives that are actually harming their people, it's going to get personal and they're likely going to stop listening to me. And it's not going to be a learning opportunity from that point on.
Okay.
And understanding that when you do live in the U.S., pretty much no matter who you are, liberalism is sort of the default ideology. And so really breaking that down piece by piece and deconstructing why they wouldn't challenge some of these identity politics as you would see. And I think some of it, again, also recognize I'm at Brown University. So it's a specific socioeconomic demographic that does exist here, a lack of proximity to suffering, which sort of like hinders their ability to be imaginative when it comes to liberation. They might sort of settle at this like intertwined integration, assimilated lifestyle with the perpetrators of global suffering, because it's better than the alternative, which is potentially us being wiped out if we up in revolt. But I think they just never really even explore what armed struggle looks like, what decolonial struggle looks like, because it's not something that's been taught to them. It's not something that's been visualized in our education intentionally, obviously. And so, you know, I try my best to bring these figures to them in a way that's applicable to their lifestyles and in a way that's looking at them as human beings. Like, I mean, Malcolm X was a cool ass dude, if you ask me, like beyond just being a revolutionary, like he gave me a sense of pride as a young black person. And so trying to bring it to them that way into where it's personal and they might be more susceptible to that information.
Okay. Adam, your perspective on that. When you dealing with your peers and others, it might be a little different for you because they might come to you and ask you questions, being that you're Palestinian and Muslim. So just talk about it from your perspective. Is it hard reaching your peers when you see things happening and you talk to them? What's the response?
Yeah. Just small correction. There's no fault on you. I'm originally Syrian, so Syrian and Muslim, but okay. It's all good. Okay. The basically, you kind of get the same thing as like, how do you feel as like an Arab person, et cetera, it's a Muslim person. And the way it, like Ethan was saying, it depends who I'm around. But especially if they are kind of just on the default ideology, if they're not really in tune with what's happening, you have to like bring them in like a nice way, right? You have to bring them in a gradual way. It's a gradual process. It's inviting them to a GBM. It's inviting them to a teach-in. It's talking with them and trying to nurture something. It's following them on Instagram and having them see what you post on your story about the current events that's happening. It's a gradual process, and we've made a lot of progress with it. But I would say, like I said before, our biggest enemy is indifference, is that people by default are, you know, inclined to just care about their career and keep going, keep moving forward. Don't worry about the things that you can directly control, or supposedly that you can directly control.
Richard?
You know, I was wondering, it's a couple of questions come to my mind as we're continuing on, and I'm kind of really exploring y'all experience as students on these campuses. One question, the thought come to my mind, as you're doing this, and I heard the term a couple of times, teach-ins, is the community reacting in the sense of what's going on in campus in relationship to creating some kind of, are you seeing any community members to engage in relationship to this Palestinian effort? I'm wondering, is there any community organizations that is being supportive to the efforts that is going, the actions that are going on in relation on the campus?
I can answer this one.
Go ahead.
I would just say for us, our campus, they call it College Hill because Brown is literally on top of a hill in the rest of the Providence community. It's actually in a black area, in a community that's been gentrified because of Brown's location, a community that suffers due to Brown's expansion of its campus, all sorts of things. And so there's been like a deliberate disconnect from us with the community. And this, I mean, in some way, the students are to blame as well by not trying to strengthen those ties. But I would just say it creates this environment where like student activism is sort of insulated in the way that I've tried to distance myself from this, but many of us just tend to view ourselves as student activists and not just black men and women fighting for liberation. You know what I'm saying? In which we would actually connect with the people who probably face these conditions more than us, who, again, reside off the campus. And so we're having teach-ins, but most of the working class communities in Providence, I haven't seen them there. We haven't invited them. We haven't done a good enough job of opening it up. And so, again, it's mostly just students getting involved who are then going to go work corporate jobs most likely and forget about all the info that was in the teaching and think that they're sort of absolved from it. But I don't know. I don't know if that was your question.
Yeah. You touching on it. And Mamadou, what about at Cornell and the relationship between the actions and going on in, you know, the community organizations connection?
Yeah. Similar to Brown, Cornell's also on a hill. And that hill, people can be in Cornell, for example, and never ever leave Cornell's campus or never go downtown and interact with the local community. But we have made like efforts, so we have off-campus groups as well, a part of our coalition, to have various voices off-campus, for example, like Catholic Workers, so that's a church away from campus, and several other groups that are part of our effort. So, and they always support our events, they always come, they always help by way of fundraising, donating. So yeah, we have definitely some local support. And the city folk don't like Cornell's institution anyway. So seeing that they have students rising up against the administration in many ways has been welcomed and I guess been able to foster great solidarity between us.
And Adam, in Maryland, University of Maryland, how in relationship to that community connection around this particular effort, how is that going on in as far as students, community relations around
us? I definitely say we're making headlines. People are hearing about what we're doing. They see us at our protests. They may read our flyers. They read through our infographics, but seldom, very few even attend our teach-ins or our educational events. This is of the student body community. Looking at the wider community, we have an anti-imperialist movement coalition here at the University of Maryland, recently started, but the two main focuses on oppression happening in Palestine and oppression in the Philippines, because in the Philippines you have a huge oppression happening with like the peasant class and putting people down, and it's a whole different story. But basically, that has brought in a lot of external orgs as well, namely like Anakbayan College Park is a Filipino cultural organization. You got Kabataan Alliance. You have these different cultural organizations from Philippine, from Palestinian backgrounds coming and supporting us, showing up. It's not as they're not as numerous as the students, but it's still something to consider. But I will say, like Ethan was saying, we are isolated because when you put things into the student activism bin, for some people, that's automatically a place that they will never go. Even if they they proclaim strong morals and they proclaim their desire for justice and for liberation and for the rights of an oppressed people, they will still, in the back of their minds, kind of check out when they hear that kind of thing.
And I'll take it that we'll come back to it. Hopefully in the time as far as exchanging. And Elliot, I know you wanted to make that show that connection through these three generation of student activists. And as I was listening to Baba Mukasa, and in that time period, and you heard him describe the activism that was going on in relationship to students. I mean, it was more, I don't want to say more or less, but it was different than now, right? Saying that being the first generation and this being the third generation of activism, the environment was different. And I think that that's important in relationship to the community, us in general, how we're receiving this, this I call it fascism, this global fascism that is going on, which is being really displayed with through the Zionist effort against the Palestinian people. But I'll just stop there as I'm reflecting on that.
And that's the common thread that we see through all of that activism. And you'll hear it from Brother Obi when he comes on about this Zionist incursion when it gets to a certain point. As far as especially young blacks, maybe students of color, when they cross that line, so to speak, what happens to them? Ta-Nehisi Coates mentioned, and I guess he's a little bit younger. He might be in between Brother Obi and Ethan and them generation. But he talked about his fear at first of even dealing with this issue. And that fear was the reprisal from a lot of these organizations, Zionist organizations, that provide money in the journalist field and on college campuses, things of that nature. In fact, if I can find that, I want to play that for Ethan, for Mamadou, and for Adam, what he said. I don't know whether Mamadou, did you hear some of the comments that he made when he went over to Palestine? I see your mic is still open, Mamadou.
Sorry,
who's coming? Yeah, Ta-Nehisi Coates. Did you hear any of his comments he made?
Some of them, no. I've been following him as he's been coming back to the United States. I know he was a bit, I guess, ambivalent before he went over there, but yes, he's been more decisive in his stance now.
Well, he mentioned that he was afraid before he went over there to speak out on these issues. But I just want to play some of that and then come back and ask you men a couple of questions. Hold on a second. Let me see if I can pull that up. It's a couple of clips here in relation to that.
I had this degree of anxiety about going because I knew I was going to see something, something I couldn't quite name. And I knew because of my upbringing, because of my mother, because of my father, because of my wife, because of my son, because of my community, that after I saw the thing, I would have to come back and talk about it. That there was no option in which I did not talk about it. And I thought I was going to another country. But in fact, what amazed me was I actually felt that I was in the same country. But I was in a different time. I was in the time of my parents and my grandparents. I can think back to all of the articles I've read, all the things I've seen said about how complicated and how complex the situation is and the occupation is. It's complex. It's complicated. And it's made to sound as though you need a degree in Middle Eastern studies or some such, a PhD, to really understand what's happening. But I understood the first day. We went to East Jerusalem to try to visit in the way that Muslims visit to Al-Aqsa Mosque. And I can remember being there, and there were four IDF guards, biggest guns I'd ever seen in my life. And they checked IDs, and they gave us our IDs back. And then they did nothing. They just made us wait. And we waited, and we waited, and we waited. There was no list. There was no protocol. There was no anything. They were just making us wait because they could. And somewhere in the back of my mind, I was like, I know what this is. I know exactly what this is. The second day we went to Hebron. And I can remember walking down streets with a Palestinian guide. And we would get to certain streets and he would say, I can't walk down this street with you. You can walk, I cannot. Because I'm Palestinian. And I thought, I know what that is. As we drove through the occupied territories and I would look out and I would see roads that Palestinians could use and roads that only Israeli Jews could use, I said, I know what this is. As I saw different colored license plates for different classes of people, I said, I know what this is. As I saw communities that I can only describe as segregated, I said, this is Chicago. It's Baltimore. It's Philadelphia. And I don't mean to center the whole world on America. We have a tendency to do that. But my lens is my lens. This is all I have. And what I felt was a tremendous weight. I felt the obvious thing that I think all of us feel, that our tax dollars are effectively subsidizing apartheid, or subsidizing a segregationist order, a Jim Crow regime. But I also felt that as an African American who was reared on the fight against Jim Crow, against white supremacy, against apartheid, I felt tremendous shame. How could I not know? How could I not know that the only democracy in the Middle East as it builds itself is segregated? How did I not know that? And what I came to, Michelle, was that Israel is a democracy, the only democracy in the Middle East, in the exact same way that America is the oldest democracy in the world.
Let me play this next portion. It's about a little over a minute.
What would it mean for all the suffering that I've endured as a black person individually? What would it mean for all of the violence that we've endured ourselves, for all the babies that were bombed in churches, for the fact that we as a people are the products of rape and sexual assault, that it marks every one of us down to our genes? What would it mean to have suffered some 250 years of enslavement, a period longer than our time of freedom? And to derive from that, that what we really need is power. And what we do with that power really doesn't matter as long as we safeguard ourselves. I was watching the news yesterday, and I saw, in fact, my congressman, actually. And journalists asked him, he said, how do you measure the amount of death, the body count? At what point is it enough? At what point do you say, you know what, this is actually too much, this is actually tipping into something? And my man couldn't give a number. He couldn't say when it was too much. Mm-hmm. And some people will watch that and get angry, and I understand that. And I watched it and got really sad.
I'm going to leave that there. Mamadou, when you hear him reach his awakening, so to speak, where he felt as though he couldn't take it anymore, he had to speak on it. You and Ethan and Adam reached a point when you were at those universities where you had to speak on it and organize others. Mamadou, you talked about teach-ins. that it was necessary to inform and give the people the information and background on what's going on. These are the bones and sinews, so to speak, of being an organizer. And we'll hear from an organizer when you men leave. But this is the beginnings of what we all need here. Whether you're talking about the Americas, whether you're talking about on the continent of Africa, whether you're talking about the area of Gaza and what's going on. Organization, the people speaking out, and the people informed on what's really going on is what we really need. And I want to thank you, brothers, for being on these campuses and risking a lot. Richard, I think these young men are putting themselves at risk, because I know that these campuses and these people in power on these campuses feel as though that if these young men are here at this school getting an education, we can put some type of pressure on them where they'll stop doing what they're doing, whether it's to cut student loans if they're there on a scholarship, cut a scholarship, put pressure on their parents. I know it's a lot of, if they're not doing it, they're thinking about doing it. So it takes a lot of courage to what these young men are doing. And I know, did you agree, Richard?
Oh, definitely. And I want to use this opportunity to speak to those of the Time for Awakening audience, because this is, and you heard each one of them say how the university is geographically positioned in relationship to the community. That's important. It's not just in relationship to their action, but in relationship to the community. And again, to put it back to what Baba Mukasa was saying, you know, where the community and the universities, their activism was interconnected. I think it's important because we as the community have to be that, make a move also. If these young men are, and women who are engaged in this effort are risking, then we should be also recognizing that we have to be their protection. But if we just let them, and I think Brother Ethan, he was making, like, eventually they'll just have this as an episode and then go on into corporate America. Like, well, okay, that's what I did when I was young. More than this is an effort that is continuous over 75 years, particularly as it relates to the glow, as it relates to the struggle of African people and people who are dealing with colonialism. So I'm pleading to us, the community, to recognize that we have to be their shield instead of leaving them alone and being bare for the corporate university and its those people who support it, which we heard is a lot of Zionist support, being keeping them isolated and also uneased. We have to be their shield, and we have to make that move when they can't make it themselves, to be their protection. I think that's important.
Before we transition over to Brother Obi, let me see if a couple of callers want to ask Ethan, Mamadou, or Adam a question, or just some words of encouragement. Let's go to, we lost one of the callers. Give us a call back at 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Let's go to Philadelphia.
Hey, Brother Elliot, how you doing?
Yes, sir.
Hey, hi, Brother Richard. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. And I want to say hello to the three wonderful students tonight, and to my Muslim brother, assalamu alaikum. I pray good brother kill a happy and blessed Ramadan. You know, as a 62-year-old black man, it just does my heart so well to hear six conscious young brothers and stuff that's so conscious and aware of what's going on. I mean, y'all could easily be, you know, and y'all could be like some of our young people, like, you know, they don't have a no-care attitude or just care about yourself, your career, or care about music or sports, whatever, you know, stuff like that, which is all well and good. But the fact that y'all are young and committed like that, y'all can identify with the suffering of another people and stuff like that. Our Palestinian brothers and sisters, you can identify with their struggle. You can identify with the struggle of our people in the Congo. It just does my heart so good and the fact that y'all courageous enough to stand up on y'all respective campuses, whether it be Brown, the University of Maryland, Cornell University, and stand up for what's right against all kinds of opposition, and even opposition from some of these Negroes that look just like you, that they're so scared of these white Zionist Jews that they would come against you on their side of these people. The fact that y'all young people stand up is just beautiful, man. I'm just emotionally, I don't know what to say. I'm just so happy and pleased tonight, brothers, that y'all stand up with such courage and such grace and fight with such dignity, using your intelligence, using your mind, everything to fight back. Y'all fighting back in such a principled way and stuff. I mean, I'm overwhelmed. What can I say, you know?
Man, thank you so much. That's love. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, my brothers.
Thank you so much. It means a lot. Thank you.
Ramadan Mubarak to you as well.
Ramadan Kareem, and I just hope and pray that y'all brothers keep on doing what you're doing and keep on inspiring our people, on young people, your peers, to keep on the struggle. And I like what one of y'all brothers said and stuff. When you see, sometimes I have learned, and I'm as a 60-year-old black man, I make my share of mistakes in life, and probably gonna make some more before I leave this earth. But one thing I learned is that sometimes we deal with our people, you can't always hit them over the head with a baseball bat. Sometimes you have to use the pillow approach, so to speak, because some of our people are just ignorant or they just don't know. Now, the thing is that once you tell them these and they learn it for themselves and they continue to be ignorant, then you got to get the baseball approach, baseball bat. But like you said, with some of our people that don't know, if you come off, like you said, you come off too hard with them, they'll just tune you out and won't listen. Like, I get a good example. When Brother Elliot and Richard came on, and now that I close with this, when Brother Elliot and Richard came on tonight, they played Brother Mikasa, you know, formerly Willie Ricks and stuff. When he said about how a lot of people think that these so-called white Jews are some kind of God's chosen people, and Brother Mikasa said they're not God's chosen people. They're nothing but children of imperialism. They're children of Satan. That's what they are. And that's important because, see, and I've told this to Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on many occasions. See, some of our people, because many of our black ministers, they go to these white theologian schools, and they teach them in these schools that these white Jews over there are God's chosen people, and nothing can be further from the truth. So you have a lot of our people, they look at how they know what they're doing is wrong, but they're scared to speak out because they'll say things like, well, they're God's chosen people. You know, I don't like what they're doing. We got to go along with them because they're God's chosen people. And a good example, brothers, when I was working at the church 20-something years ago at this church in Philadelphia, I had a brother who didn't know no better. He says, Joe, I hate what they're doing to the Palestinians. He says, but what are we going to do? They are God's chosen people. And I said, who told you that? He said, well, my pastor. I said, well, where your pastor? Who told your pastor that? Well, my pastor said that he was taught that at theologian school. So you got to always remember, you're dealing with people that's got the wrong information and they're ignorant. So they actually, when you give them the right information, they start saying these white Jews or white Zionists who they are, then they stop thinking that these people are. They realize they're nothing but Europeans and stuff. They occupy somebody else's land. They start saying these white Jews for who they are. But you got to educate them first. Now, once our people get that information and they still want to talk stupid and ignorant, then that's a different story. But for some of them, you got to kind of spoon feed them and let them know that these people are not who they've been told that they are. You understand what I'm saying, brothers?
100%. Thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. And then once they know and stuff, then they'll start seeing these white Jews for who they are. Because and last point is this, like our late ancestor Maya Angelou said, when the people show you who they are, you better believe them. And I've had even Europeans tell me in Philadelphia, they don't look at these white Jews the same no more. Because before, you know, they always had the sympathy of the Holocaust. They always would bring up the Holocaust, Hitler. When they see how they're treating our Palestinian brothers and sisters, I've had white people, black people, Indians, Latinos tell me they don't want to hear another damn thing about no Holocaust. Don't even mention the Holocaust or Hitler again, because what you're doing to Palestinian people are just like Hitler-like tactics. So don't ever talk about the Holocaust or Hitler again, because you have no right to even invoke that comment no more, because what you're doing over there are definitely Nazi-like and Hitler-like. So the people will never see them, people that's righteous, will never see these white Jews the same again. After their behavior of the last 5 months, they will never, ever be looked the same by righteous people around the world. And thank you, Brother Ellis, for letting me express myself. And I'll be unmuting and listen to the rest of the show.
Thank you for your call.
You're welcome.
Let's go to... let's go to Albuquerque.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Well, I can tell you, man, I take my hats off to these young people that are going to these colleges, Brown, University of Maryland, and they right on top of it. And it's a great show as usual, and these guys are really should be commended. They're doing a fantastic job and keep up the way. And I agree with you. I think it was Richard said that we need to support these people, the older people. We need to back these young cats up, man. It's a great show. Keep it going. Thank you.
Thanks for your contribution.
Thank you so much.
Let's go to, let's see here. Caller?
Yeah, what's happening, Richard and Elliot? A quick question for the young brother from Brown. What are you majoring in at Brown?
I'm currently in the Africana Studies Department.
Who's the head of that department now?
I believe her name is Renee Atter, A-T-E-R. I think she's the head of the department, but yeah, I believe it's her. Yeah.
Okay, because you know, I enjoyed what you were saying, but I was wondering, what is the situation with most of the Black, Latino, and other minority students in regards to your protests of what's going on? Are they supportive, non-supportive, scared, worried about being kicked out of school? What is the climate?
I'd say it's a mix. Definitely the notions have been pushed upon all of us folks of color, especially Black folks, that the way for us to emulate success is to go be rich, go to experience upward social mobility. And so that's kind of contradictory to going and sacrificing that same career for a freedom struggle. And so some of them, I would say, are caught in that mix. You do have some people I definitely give credit for are out here organizing, people who probably weren't interested in going corporate anyway. But it could always be better. It could always be better. I mean, we're all of our heritages are linked to a colonized people. And so there's no reason that not all of us should be involved in our own liberation and in this one collectively. So it's a continuous process. But I'd say overall, it's got to improve. It's got to improve.
Now let me ask you this also. Most of the Black, Latino, minority student getting scholarships or placing themselves in debt with these student loans and things of that nature?
So at least at the Ivy League, so it works different at every school, at least in the Ivy League, or I think it's the whole Ivy League. I know it's for Brown, but I think it's the whole Ivy League. They do a need-based financial aid, and so whatever you can't afford, the institution covers it. So most of my peers are on full aid. I don't know if many people are taking out loans at all. I either know some people are paying what they can or they're on aid altogether.
So most of the minority students, you would say, are not coming out of there until they maybe go to law school or something like that with those 6 and 7 figure student loan debt?
Yeah, I mean, in graduate school, they might be taking out loans. I don't know for sure. I'd say one thing to remember is even the students who aren't taking out loans, who are on full aid, who might have come from working class backgrounds, a lot of those people didn't always experience the social experience of those working class backgrounds because they were sort of like the chosen ones of their community in which somebody from their city developed a high school scholarship program and was selecting young Black and Brown youth to come attend some boarding schools, some prep schools, some private school program. And so they were, many of them were the only person of color, the only Black girl or boy in their classes, despite coming from a working class background, has sort of been like handpicked to go to these private schools. And I didn't know that. I didn't even really recognize that until late in my freshman year, but it became pretty clear once I recognized all these cultural differences between even in the Black community. So,
well, you know, that's good that hopefully you won't come out of college with any type of debt. It's also good to know that you've woken up to your surroundings. And it's probably sad that a lot of the students have no idea on what the struggle is and how they're going to move forward other to be, you know, controlled by the oppressor, because the reality with the things changing the way that it is in the society, you know, hopefully they'll educate themselves to be more independent than anything, because with the class struggle that's about to happen in this country, a lot of them, yeah, they could graduate with nice degrees and all of that, but in all honesty, white folks ain't gonna employ you, if the truth be told. I mean, look at what you're competing against now. 20 years ago, and a lot of people don't understand that, black people wasn't competing with other ethnic groups the way that they were when they were of so-called elite intellectual status. Now, who are you competing with? You're competing with Indians, Chinese, other ethnic groups. So, I mean, hey, man, I'm just glad to know that you have the consciousness you have and that you're going to walk out of there with your African sense. And to your other two gentlemen that's with you, I wish them nothing but the best of luck also.
Thanks for your contribution.
Thank you.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, joining us is activist, organizer, journalist, playwright. He got a bunch of hats on his head. Is the U.S. correspondent to the Herald. Brother Obeg Bona Jr. will be joining us after the break. You can join in the conversation, too, by dialing 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. You guys can hang around with us, or if you got studies, you could do that. But thanks for being with us, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Listening to Time for an Awakening. Time for an awakening. With host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today, 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
Escape the digital plantation. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store are here for you. You are ready to be free of non-African social media. Don't run from danger, run to safety. Abibitumi.com is here for you. You are ready to be free of digital plantations to control your own products. Abibitumi.store is here for you. ABIBITUMI, Black Power, ABIBITUMI. The only word you need to know to join your global Kometz U Black family, to join your interconnected Kometz U Black communities, escape the digital plantation now. Abibitumi.com, Abibitumi.tv, Abibitumi.tv.com, Abibitumi.store. We are here for you. Escape the digital plantation.
We are the watchmen on the wall.
You are too. You watch with a political eye. We watch from a spiritual eye. But we're supposed to be the watchmen for the people that vote for us. The sad thing is the people vote, but they don't give you the money to run your campaigns. So here come big business.
How are you? How are you, Judge? How are you, Alderman? How are you, Congressman? How are you? How are you, Reverend? Well, what can I do for you today, Reverend? You can't do nothing for me.
See, that's what we got to be careful of. We got to be careful of who we bow down to. But see, when you get in your congregation and you talk this Jesus, this powerful Jesus that's sitting at the right hand of the Father with all power in his hand, then you go with your hat in your hand to the governor, to the mayor, to the president, begging for some crumbs. You have sold your God cheap. And you make the white man downtown disrespect all of us. Yeah.
In short, the lords of capital are creatures of U.S. imperial dominance. They go out of business when the empire does. The rulers are looking class death in the face, and it terrifies them. And when the lords of capital become frightened, they order their servants in politics and the war industries and the vast national security networks to take care of the problem by any means necessary. That means militarily encircling Russia and China, arming and mobilizing tens of thousands of jihadist terrorists in Syria in an attempt to repeat the regime change in Libya, waging a war of economic sanctions and low-level armed aggression against Iran, occupying most of the African continent through subversion of African militaries, escalating subversion in Latin America, and spying on everyone on Earth with a digital connection. All this to stop the clock that is ticking on U.S. and European world economic dominance.
The Organization of Afro-American Unity shall include all people of African descent in the Western Hemisphere. In essence, what it is saying, instead of you and me running around here seeking allies in our struggle for freedom in the Irish neighborhood or the Jewish neighborhood or the Italian neighborhood, we need to seek some allies among people who look something like we do. And once we get their allies, it's time out for you and me to stop running away from the wolf right into the arms of the fox, looking for some kind of help. Number two, self-defense. We assert the Afro-Americans' right to self-defense. The Constitution of the United States of America clearly affirms the right of every American citizen to bear arms. And as Americans, we will not give up a single right guaranteed under the Constitution. The history of unpunished violence against our people clearly indicates that we must be prepared to defend ourselves, or we will continue to be a defenseless people at the mercy of a ruthless and violent racist mob.
Time for an Awakening is a proud part of the Black Talk Radio Network, the number one independent black digital and podcasting platform.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. It's 8:41 on this Sunday edition of Time for an Awakening. We're going to transition over to our next guest to kind of bring things home for us. Activist, organizer, and journalist, playwright, and U.S. correspondent to the Herald, which is Zimbabwe's national newspaper, Brother Obi Igbona Jr. Uh-oh. We're getting a little feedback there. I think that's on you. Okay, I think
it was on my end.
Yeah, it was, but you're good now.
Okay. Good evening.
Yeah. Brother Obi, listen, you heard the beginning when we played Brother Mukasa, the elder, and he talked about when he was a young man and what he went through as far as organizing and the enemy that was kind of pushing the buttons in the background, so to speak. It reminds me of that show, The Wizard of Oz, and it was when they pulled the curtain back, it was a young man, I mean, it was a little short guy pulling the levers in the back. Well, he talked about that same type of dynamic. I know you experienced that as a young student organizer for the Million Man March back in the early 90s. But talk about it from your perspective as a young student organizer and bring it up to date as far as the action plans and practical things that people can do now to kind of... Uh-oh. Yeah, we're getting a little feedback on your end, Brother Obi.
Okay, let me... Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Well, thank you. Good to be with you again. It's been a minute. Good to be with you and Brother Richard. And, okay, the reason we organized the teaching, for the record, I'm the former U.S. correspondent to the Herald, Zimbabwe's national newspaper. I stepped away from that 2 years ago, but it was great for me. From 2006 to 2020, I wrote for the paper. I assumed that responsibility in 2008, over 400 articles, and we're going to do something with that very soon. But in relationship to Zimbabwe work, while I was there, the first time I went in 2006, as it's relevant to tonight, I joined the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association, and I was recruited by the Cuban ambassador to Zimbabwe at the time, His Excellency Cosme Torres Espinosa, who was the highest-ranking Cuban diplomat to be deported from the United States. He was deported 21 years ago under false charges of espionage. His next detail was to be the Cuban ambassador to Zimbabwe, and he recruited me into that organization, one of the greatest honors I've had. And I serve at the moment as the first external relations officer that organization has ever had. And my assignment is to build bridges around Cuba work done in the Caribbean, Cuban work done in Europe, Cuban work done in North America, and Cuban work done on the African continent. Let's take it back to Mukasa, though. So we organized that teach-in with Brother Ethan, with Brother Mamadou, and with Brother Adam last week that you saw. And the reason that we invited Mukasa there is because the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, their budget was frozen after they condemned the Six-Day War, Israel bombing, Zionist Israel bombing not only Egypt/Kemet, but Syria for 6 days straight with some heavy armament. And so I met Brother Mukasa 33 years ago on March 8th, 1991. When we brought him to UDC, when I was a student there. And later on that evening, I was in an organization called the Pan-African Student Youth Movement at the time. And we invited him, Brother Kwame Ture, and the widow of Fred Hampton, Sister Akua Njeri, to talk about African liberation. Later on that evening, I was involved in a meeting at Ujamaa Shule, the first African independent school in this country, founded by Baba Elsa Kingulu Zulu, formerly known as Lester McKinney, freedom rider Lester McKinney with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, Brother Kwame's first boss and SNCC. And in the basement, we had a meeting with the late Kwame Afoe, the provisional government of the Republic of New Africa president. And it was about... joining the Worldwide African Anti-Zionist Front. And that was created in Libya at the end of 1990. That's relevant to this conversation because when we think about Zionism, it's broken down into two parts for us. You think of, first let me go back. So the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, they became involved in anti-Zionist work because great sisters, this is Women's Month, it'd be sinful to ignore her name, Ethel Miner, Ethel Miner wrote a paper for them called The Palestinian Problem. Prior to that, she was Brother Malcolm's secretary in the OAAU before he was assassinated. And if people remember Brother Malcolm's trip to Egypt/Kemet in 1964, where he met with Gamal Abdel Nasser, he wrote an article in the Egyptian Gazette, the country's national newspaper, called Zionist Logic. And he broke down the false narrative of Zionism and Judaism being the same, Zionism being an atheist philosophy, saying God doesn't exist, but at the same time masquerading as being Judaic, saying that God chose that land for their people. So if you're a Zionist, you can't be a Muslim, you can't be a Jew, you can't be a Christian, you can't be a Buddhist, you can't be a Confucianist, you can't be anything that claims that there's a higher force, a spiritual force, a supreme being, so to speak. So Brother Malcolm took that on courageously. Ethel Miner passes that on to SNCC. And then, of course, their generation in 1990, this happens. We wanted to be part of it. So to answer the question that was asked earlier, as a student-based organization, we were an umbrella of students at UDC, Trinity, Catholic University, University of Maryland, College Park. So we wanted to join that front. We wanted to be the first student youth entity in it. So we sat in a room with the Republic of New Africa, Chokwe Lumumba Sr., the New African People's Organization, Viola, the late Viola Plummer, and the late Coltrane Chimurenga with the December 12th movement, Muhammad Ahmed, then known as Max, once known as Max Sanford, with the Revolutionary Action Movement. And they were wondering, could we handle the pressure? Could we handle the challenge? And when we told them what motivated us to be there, they were very happy. So about a year ago, I met Brother Mamadou at a rally around Palestine at Cornell when I was invited there. And they had protested Lockheed Martin one day, were challenging Zionist Israel. And we talked to them about how at the age of 21, we got involved in that work. And it was centered around the Worldwide African Anti-Zionist Front. It was centered around the bombing of Libya in 1986, which was instigated by the Zionist State of Israel, when Israel and the Reagan administration put out false propaganda that Libya bombed a disco in Berlin. Mm-hmm. And it justified a cowardly military attack that led to the loss of the life of 2-year-old Hannah Gaddafi, the 2-year-old daughter of Muammar Gaddafi. So when the Obama administration and NATO, instigated by Zionist Israel, bombed Libya for 7 months in a row, they were following up on what Reagan did in 1986. And then in 1987, 150 organizations in this country defied the travel ban that Reagan had imposed on Libya, and they went in the tradition of the Freedom Riders and defied that. So we studied that, learned about that, and we wanted to become active in that process. So in the 1990s, we were dealing with the question of Zionism. And so this is 1991, we're now speaking of. And the first thing we took part in was in 1992, we marched on the White House around the question of Libya. And through that process, we got to work with the American Indian Movement, Grand Governing Council, with the great Vernon Belcourt, whose traditional name is Wabuninini, the Mayan of Dawn from the White Earth Reservation in Mankato, Minnesota, who would always begin every presentation he had with, "We are the Palestinians and the Palestinians are us." So anti-Zionism was very essential, very crucial to our makeup and development as we chose the path of revolution. So we got to work with the Pan-Africanist Congress of Azania. We got to work with the Black Consciousness Movement of Azania / ASAPO. We got to work with the Democratic Party of Guinea. We got to work with all these revolutionary movements in the United States and throughout the diaspora and on the African continent and the representation that they had in this country. And we passed around that article by Brother Malcolm. Simultaneous with the T-shirt that we had was the T-shirt with Muammar Gaddafi and Madiba Nelson Mandela walking together when they had their meeting. So we knew that in the early 90s, we would try to play the most aggressive role we could in dealing with the question of Zionist Israel being an enemy of African people. So we know that Palestinian solidarity, that's the tip of the iceberg. But the fact that they bombed Egypt and Kemet in 1967 for 7 days, the fact that they were the only nation that stood up in the UN and said they failed to recognize the independence and sovereignty of Algeria and then did the same thing to Tunisia. The fact that they are the only other nation on earth in favor of this monstrous blockade on Cuba. And on January 15th, there was a Cuban solidarity meeting in what was called South Africa, and a resolution came out around the Palestinian question. So on Monday night of last week, we presented an action plan that represents three generations. And I'll go over that real quick. Number one, we want all the Israeli embassies on the African continent shut completely down. We want the African Union, but not just the African Union, our regional bodies, COMESA, ECOWAS, NAPAD, SADC, to break diplomatic ties with Israel. There should be no Israeli embassies on the African continent, and we should bring Israel up on all their crimes against the African continent. At the moment, in the last 10, 15 years, even Amnesty International exposed this. Several police departments, U.S.-based, have gone to Zionist Israel to be trained by the Israeli Defense Forces in stopping popular uprisings. So we're going to talk to Raz Baraka because of the relationship, going back to our student days, the mayor of Newark, Chokwe Lumumba Jr. because of his family pedigree, and we're going to ask them to take the lead in having a sit-down with our three mayoral bodies. We have three. The African American Mayoral Alliance, the National Conference of Black Mayors, and our brother Johnny Ford with the World Conference of Mayors. And we are demanding that they write sworn statements to our community that never again, or in any situation, do we allow police departments in the United States to go to Israel to get any training. The pigs in the United States are filthy enough, they don't need to go rolling in slop with the IDF. They're already filthy enough, barbaric enough, fascist enough, genocidal enough. We don't need that. As last year was the 50th anniversary of hip-hop, in addition to the lyrics, in addition to the breakdancing, in addition to the DJing, in addition to the graffiti, another aspect of hip-hop is the fashion and jewelry. And many of our hip-hop artists have popularized diamonds and gold. So we had M1 from Dead Prez there with us, and we had the Grammy-nominated artist Maymuna Youssef, whose stage name is Moo Moo Fresh. And we're asking them to go and call a meeting with these artists, and we want to ask these artists who have fancy jewelry, who have diamonds, gold, and other jewelry, to go back to the appraisers of their jewels. And if it can be confirmed that those jewels found their way to the Diamond District in New York through Zionist Israel, they need to return those jewels back to the jeweler, get the compensation, and we can figure out what else can be done with that money. Maybe we can finance Cuba's efforts on the African continent, medical efforts. So we talked about Egypt and Kemet. You have Dr. Tony Browder, you have Ashwa Kwesi, and you have the Association for Classic African Civilizations, Brother Ronald McCoy, right there in Philly, our brother. We need to ask them to begin to do some excavation, not only of the kings and queens of a million years ago, let's dig up the bones of those people who were slaughtered in 1967. We dare to say that their bones are just as important as Imhotep's, just as important as Nefertiti's, just as important as King Tut's, just as important as any of the people from those dynasties, their bones, their blood, them being 4 or 6 feet under the ground because of the savage bombing of sacred Kemet, the mother of one of the mothers of civilization, dig up their bones and let us begin to use that bombing in 67 the same way the Japanese use Hiroshima and Nagasaki to expose the United States. We also know that this highlights a class struggle that has gone on, because on the question of Zionism, we've always been divided. You've had Malcolm on one side. You had Kwame Ture, who used to say the only good Zionist is a dead Zionist. You've had the Nation of Islam, and we salute them for their lawsuit that they have. But on the other side, The only blemish of Dr. King on foreign policy is he supported Israel in 1967. But this is primarily because of the coercion of Bayard Rustin and Harry Belafonte. Bayard Rustin, who wrote Golda Meir a letter praising her for how she was slaughtering Palestinians. And if you know Golda Meir's background, she said, there's no such thing as a Palestinian because I'm going to get rid of all of them. Harry Belafonte takes credit for popularizing the song Hava Nagila, which celebrates the Balfour Declaration. For your listeners who don't know, this was a diplomatic piece of paper in 1914 that was written to lay the foundation for Israel. How does this relate to the never-ending lovers' quarrel between Democrats and Republicans? It was a Democrat named Truman that brought Israel to life, but it was a civil rights alum named Ralph Bunche who did the dirty work, who did the covering up, who helped perpetuate the masquerade. If you are football fans, you know that the longest commercial during the Super Bowl this year was Dr. King's old attorney, Clarence Jones, who they gave him a long commercial space to reaffirm his support for Zionist Israel. The spokesperson of the Moral Monday movement and the person being credited with reigniting the Poor People's Campaign, he's used his platforms to attack Hamas. So we know in our community, and of course we said sympathy with the Palestinians, they don't need it. It's only solidarity when we are fighting Israel for their crimes against us. So we'll fight them on, and for those people who call them, who are born again Black Americans, who have plantation love, who feel that one's identity, the best measurement is your passport and your birth certificate, not your history and culture. You got a role to play in this. If you don't care about Palestine, if you don't care about Israel's crimes against Zimbabwe, Israel's crimes against Namibia, Israel's crimes against Mozambique, well, understand that those police that went to Israel to be trained, Detroit police, Baltimore police, New York police, Boston police, they might kill your children. They might kill your mother. They might kill your grandmother. So even if you want to North Americanize your identity, there's a role for you to play in this fight as well. So we wanted to have an action plan that spoke to every demographic. And as you know, Brother Elliot, you were there. You heard the churches, the 1,000 churches that have engaged the administration on this question. We wanted to have them there. And they're important because Theodor Herzl, the founder of the Zionist movement, was an atheist. He wasn't a Jew. He just knew the importance of masquerading the Jewish faith. And we understood why that was important for them. And this is why when Ahmed Sékou Touré, leader of the Guinean Revolution, the president of Guinea, pushed the resolution at the UN, Zionism is Racism, Resolution 3379, him being a devout Muslim, that meant something. Because they have slaughtered Africans and Palestinians, have been slaughtered by Israel in the name of Judaism, the same way our ancestors were snatched from Africa in the name of Jesus Christ. And the only thing worse is when people use spirituality as an excuse to sit on their hands and not fight against oppressive forces. So that's what we did last Monday. We put that action plan out. But it was to complement the Sassada Shakur Cuba defense campaign. And we are asking you, Brother Elliot, to go through, and Richard, to go through your Rolodex of all your guests that you've ever had and ask them to support these campaigns, to support these initiatives. Some people are saying they weren't aware. Even if you're aware and now you're enlightened, it's been brought to your attention, and all you're going to do is do commentary, you can keep your comments to yourself. We need, this is an illustration of why the Valley of Talking Heads can be so problematic. So you go somewhere, you travel, you speak, you say a few words. There's no substitute for action. There's no substitute for organizing. So we're going to talk to the father of Ta-Nehisi Coates to see if his son will bring us to Howard, or he'll be there when we come, because we're coming soon and we can challenge him. And he's a son of a panther. And if you know the history of the Palestinians, Brother Kwame Ture talked about an African guerrilla fighter named Fatima Benawi, the first woman to carry out guerrilla initiatives on behalf of the Palestinian people. She's a Palestinian-born African. And to those people who are saying this is not an African thing, you must have the same geography teacher that Christopher Columbus had when he thought he was in India when he got here. Palestine is in Africa. Syria is in Africa. The Middle East is nothing but an extension of North Africa. And if we keep acting like North Africa doesn't matter to us, imperialism will bomb North Africa, pollute North Africa, rape North Africa, loot Northern Africa, and we'll act like it has nothing to do with us. You'll conveniently dust off your copy of The Destruction of Black Civilization, taking it out of context. I make a distinction between Gamal Abdel Nasser, a revolutionary Arab who saved Brother Malcolm's life when the CIA poisoned him, who introduced Osagyefo, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, to his second wife, Fatima, and Anwar Sadat, a puppet, or Hosni Mubarak, who between the years of 1979 and 2010, Egypt under Mubarak got more money from the United States than any other nation on earth except Zionist Israel. So Nasser is a revolutionary Arab. Gaddafi is a revolutionary Arab. Ahmed Ben Bella, who led the revolution in Algeria, is a revolutionary Arab. Abdel Karim of the Morocco Independence Party, who the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey and the UNIAACL supported, is a revolutionary Arab. But I make a distinction between them and the monarchs in Saudi Arabia, the monarchs in Dubai, the Arab puppets in different parts of the world, or the Arabs who came and kidnapped our ancestors before the Europeans did. You have to make that distinction. If you don't, then you're not honest. So this is an opportunity to really have the most full-fledged strategy that we can move on dealing with Zionists, fighting them on the basis of militarization and police terrorism in this country, fighting them for their crimes against Africa, fighting them for maintaining the blockade against Cuba, fighting them for the jewelry that represents the rape and plunder of Africa that they allow to be passed through their nation, Congolese diamonds that pass through Israel, Zimbabwean diamonds that pass through Israel, and to let our artists know that in their efforts to look appealing and their efforts to make a fashion statement, making a horrendous political statement, and exposure is the key to everything. So that's what we came together to do Monday. Yes, it ended up being three generations of resistance. It ended up being, you saw the churches there, but you also saw Burkina Faso young people there. You saw the Socialist Workers United to Save Haiti there. You saw the Friends of the Congo there. You saw the pastors there. You saw the artists there. We brought everybody together because we realized that at many of these demonstrations that are taking place, you only hear one expression, ceasefire. While we don't want another Palestinian child to die at the hands of Zionist assaults, no Palestinian women or men, we realize that they are Zionists in the United States who have infiltrated the peace movement, infiltrated the anti-war movement. And the reason they're calling for a ceasefire is to help Zionist Israel buy time, an extra second, an extra minute, an extra hour, an extra day, an extra month, an extra year. So we're on alert. We're organizing. We'll keep fighting. And we just want to bring people together. And these young people, we pulled them close to us the same way that Kwame Ture and Mukasa Dada pulled us close to them in 1990, 1991, 1992, when we were their age. And we were introduced to this aspect of revolutionary work.
Brother Obi, listen, you kind of laid it out clear and concise. One question, and I'll pass over to Richard. Being that your connections on the continent, as far as being a journalist for a number of years, I know that you know a lot of other journalists and people on the continent. I do know that several, or at least South Africa and maybe a few other African countries, have withdrawn their diplomat or sent Israel's diplomat home. Now, that might be a difference between closing their embassy.
We're saying shut them down permanently, never to be open again, never to be open again. A few years ago, when we called for the restitution of the damages the Cubans had for the blockade, Israel had observer status at the AU for the longest. They had it when it was still the OAU, for whatever reason. That was suspended.
Yeah, I did know
that. But we're saying that they need to be shut down and they need to be brought up on crimes. But we'll take things any way we can get them. The Zionists felt so comfortable cornering Madiba Nelson Mandela back in the day just for meeting with Arafat, Ted Koppel, how could you? And then when he walked off the General Assembly for the UN, B'nai B'rith and the ADL and AIPAC, they all cornered him. So to have the African National Congress have a lawsuit against Zionism is definitely, that's our work. And Kwame Ture told us when we were pups in struggle, one of the privileges that many fighters are not afforded is the privilege of witnessing victory. So we consider that a victory. We consider that part of our work. So we'll take that. And to have pastors, men and women of cloth. When I spoke with Barbara Williams Skinner, the head of the African American Clergy Network, man, I had a smile like the Kool-Aid commercial. Just to know that we've got Christian preachers challenging Zionism. But this is our work. And this is the work of those of us who have reminded people that Zionism is an atheist philosophy. But we feel it needs a militant complement. So to say that they must be brought up on crimes dealing with Africa is important. To say that the raping and plundering of the land, those diamonds, that gold, they have their hands on that. Now we talking Oppenheimer. Now we talking the Anglo-American Corporation. Now, when we talk about their militarization of Africa, they gave military aid to all the settler colonies. Southern Rhodesia before it became Zimbabwe, Portuguese East Africa before it became Mozambique. We haven't forgotten about any of that. And as Benjamin Crump and one of Malcolm's daughters is talking about the NYPD, the FBI, and the CIA, we can now deal with the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence, because if Malcolm writes an article in Kemet about Zionism, you don't think the Mossad's open up a file on him? So we need to get their files on everybody they're watching in our community, all out war on the Zionist state of Israel. We should settle for nothing else. And as long as we have the most militant response, and the most militant response shows, Brother Elliot, we're fighting them. You remind me in 1993 of a sit down I had with Khalid Muhammad, considered one of our boldest. And we told him straight up, we were 23 at the time. Condemning Israel is one thing, fighting them is another thing, because we felt the Nation of Islam belonged at the table with the Worldwide African Anti-Zionist Front, but for some reason they did not join. So, and we know how the apex culturally now of condemning something or saying something, that's not enough, because we know some people have perfected tough talk at podium tough talk, as we call it. So we expect Julius Malema and the EFF to be part of this effort to call for Israel to be driven off the African continent. No Israeli embassy should exist by the end of this year in Africa. No African nation should have diplomatic ties to Israel by the end of this year. We should push for that. That means that because we have the momentum, we have history on our side, and this gives us a chance to correct the mistakes of those who came before us. To correct the mistake of Mandela, to correct the mistake of King, to correct the mistake of Harry Belafonte, to correct the mistake of Bayard Rustin, to correct the mistake of everyone that has shown Israel some type of love on a cultural level, on a political level, on a social level. This is the opportunity to finally correct that and do the right thing. Do right by history, do right by Africa. So that's all we want to do. We're not trying to embarrass anybody. We're not trying to criticize anybody, but we must challenge everybody, because I've been hearing a bunch of people give their opinion of the African National Congress's lawsuit or mention what they feel these pastors should do, but there is a variety of activities that we can be engaged in. Can you imagine if all our hip-hop artists take their blame to their jeweler and say, man, did this come through Israel? And if they tell them the truth and they give that back to them, can you imagine if you think about every march, every demonstration against naked police terrorism in the United States, if we challenge our mayors and say that you cannot send police to Israel anymore, what that will do? Could you imagine if everybody that is fighting for the blockade on Cuba to be lifted begins to condemn Israel for being the only other nation stupid enough and arrogant enough to maintain that monstrous policy? So we're talking about all out wherever we are, more than we ever have before. And we don't think we're asking for much, because the momentum is definitely moving in that direction. Don't touch this. If we look at the perpetual motion of our people. So we're happy, and we're happy to be in this strategic place. We're happy to be plugged in. You saw us in Selma, Brother Elliot. You saw how well what we said was received. Standing right there next to Ben Chavis, standing right there next to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, standing right there next to Reverend Willie Barber's number two, because this is creating an atmosphere for full spectrum engagement. And those of us who've always been considered on the far left, on a strategical and tactical level, we have some activity to offer that's going to raise the level of resistance for the purpose of qualitatively transforming the landscape. So if fighting Zionism provides that atmosphere for us, then history obligates us to intensify our work indeed. The same man, Congressman Tom Lantos, a Zionist, who moved to use the halls of Congress against Khalid Muhammad, that's the same Tom Lantos that pushed the Congressional Black Caucus to support sanctions on Zimbabwe. And he still had a hatred for the Zimbabwean people because of their support for the Palestinians. As a matter of fact, when I was in Zimbabwe, the first foreign minister in the country's history, the national hero, Dr. Nathan Shamiriro, when I was there, he wanted me to help him revive the Zimbabwean-Palestinian Friendship Association, because the Zimbabweans gave the PLO an embassy as early as 1983. They had one in Angola. They had one in Mozambique. As a matter of fact, when the Southern African liberation movements, all involved in armed struggle, were going to the OAU for the Liberation Committee meetings where their armed struggles were financed, Yasser Arafat would come personally and give his messages of solidarity. Andrew Young was fired for meeting with Yasser Arafat by Jimmy Carter, who all of a sudden is a born-again Palestinian sympathizer. You see how last week the Biden administration relaxed sanctions on Zimbabwe. But we know the strategy. If you're about to lynch me, I don't want a relaxed noose on my neck. Our ancestors didn't want relaxed shackles on their arms, wrists, and neck when they were snatched from Africa. We want the sanctions on Zimbabwe completely ended. So, but they did that because they don't want the Zimbabwe in question to catch fire as the world is rallying around Palestine, because this gives life to Africans of St. Croix, Africans of St. Lucia, Africans of St. Thomas, Africans in Puerto Rico, who we forget are still settler colonialist occupied territories themselves. So this is the question of armament now becomes a question of how, as a result of militarization, U.S. imperialism is arming the world, arming the world's most wicked. So fighting Zionism gives us a chance to bring clarity to a lot of different issues that represent the unfinished business of the path of African revolution. And we're just happy to play the smallest role possible in bringing students together with artists, with clergy, with journalists, whoever we need to bring together so that this work takes flight properly and we hit our target. We want to shoot, but we don't want to miss. So we're just happy to be in a position to do that.
Let me get Richard in here because, hold on. Richard?
Yeah.
I think Brother Obi covered a lot of the bases, but go ahead.
No, I think Brother Obi, you laid out everything that I think we need to do, right? It's not in relationship to, you know, what I
I think the way I'm projecting to the Time for Awakening audience, where we need to, and you know, bringing this clarity that you mentioned, that we, what we need to do. So the only question I would ask is, how do we, who is hearing this, so that we don't become those just talking about it, those talking heads, how do we get engaged?
You guys are based in Philadelphia. So you have a young brother there that's been doing this work for a minute named Gabe Bryant. We had Russell Schultz, who's one of our coordinators for this Assata Shakur Cuba Defense Campaign. He was one of the co-MCs the other night, y'all saw him. So we would like to talk to Gabe, and we would like to get together with Meek Mill and Gilly and some of these hip-hop personalities and some of these athletes in Philadelphia who have the jewelry. And we want them to go to their jeweler and say, did my jewelry come through Israel? Is my jewelry anyway connected to Israel? Is your shop connected to Israel? And if that is the case, we want compensation for our jewelry. We had Dr. Tasneen Siddiqui, who's at Drexel University, who talked about the relationship between Drexel University and Israel and the gentrification of Philadelphia. So that is work right there. And Brother Elliot and I have spoken. I spoke with Brother Shamari at WRD. They feel that a civil, respectful, intelligent conversation, meeting of the mind, should take place between Dr. Umar Johnson and yours truly on what the role of Africans should be in this anti-Zionist fight. Because he seems to function from the understanding that this is an Arab dynamic. No, this is a continuation of Malcolm X's work. This is an extension of Kwame Ture's work. This is an extension of the Nation of Islam's work. This is an extension of ZANU-PF's work, Free Limo's work, MPLA's work. Africans have been fighting Israel since its inception. So maybe we don't know what his points of reference are, but the benefit of having a conversation would... those blanks will be filled in, and we'll push the same plan of action. So it doesn't matter where we are. If there are clergy in Philadelphia that are involved, part of that 1,000 clergy membership, they should pick up their work. But if not, they should get involved with that. They should work with the churches. There's work for artists to do. There's work for students to do. There's many people in Philadelphia are looking to invest in Africa. So this can be part of the fight where there's a seventh desk at the African Union now for diasporic affairs. We can ask the African Union to officially terminate Israeli airspace, shut down those buildings, turn them into schools, turn them into hospitals, fumigate them because of the filth that Israel represents before you get them out of there. So there's work for everybody in numerous capacities. We wanted to present a strategy that spoke to everybody. So there's work for artists, there's work for clergy, there's work for students, there's work for journalists, there's work for everybody. And we would love to have that conversation with Umar Johnson. We'd be willing to come to Philadelphia physically to do that. And because we take a Pan-African approach, and this is our work. This isn't opinion-based. This isn't commentary-based. So if people are saying they did not know, I don't know what their references are, but if people just study the civil and human rights movement, they'll see the revolutionary force. That's why we had Brother Mukasa there, so people can know that SNCC played a role in this work. They know that Dr. King's blemish is here. They see all these civil and human rights leaders who've always been intimidated by the Zionist state of Israel. So, like I said, so the education and the enlightenment will take place, but not at the expense of activity and perpetual motion never being stagnant. So people can do a multitude of things. Once again, and there are many, you have Ronald McCoy, who is very active with his ASCAP chapter. We need to push for the bones of the people who were slaughtered in 1967. Finding their bones should now be part of people's excavation efforts. So we're going to talk to Tony Browder. And once again, their bones are just as valuable as the bones of the dynasties from millions of years ago. That happened in 1967, which speaks to something I've been trying to get Tony Browder to do for 14 years. do a seminar with us called Africa Yesterday, Africa Today, Africa Tomorrow, where we will take the history from a million years ago and bring it up to, as what Flip Wilson said when he played Reverend Leroy, what's happening now, and talk about what happened 15 minutes ago, 20 minutes ago in Africa, so that people realize that Africa is a part of our past, our present, and our future. So no African in North America or Europe or Australia or Latin America ever refers to developments on the African continent as foreign policy, foreign to me, foreign to you, treating Africa like it's another part of the solar system. So the benefits of the work are endless. It's just a question, and the work has been going on. It's just that, as we know, when we usually have these assemblies these days, people are talking about what we need to do, and they're disconnected from the actual work going on, and they deliberately exclude the workers and the laborers from these gatherings. So that's why it looks like work hasn't been done. And for the record, Israel, same in 2024 as it was in 2014, as it was in 2004, as it was in 1994, 84, 74, 64, 54. It's the same. It's a vicious, barbaric, bloodthirsty settler colony. And until it dies, we have no problem telling you it must die. Like we said Monday night, bury it next to Portuguese East Africa. Bury it next to Southwest Africa. Bury it next to the Gold Coast. Bury it next to Upper Volta. So an indigenous name representing self-determination, us being masters of our own destiny. They can have that. We want them to experience what we experienced on April 18th in Zimbabwe, 1980, when the Zimbabwean flag came up and the British Union Jack came down. We want them to experience what we experienced in Ghana on March 6, 1957, when the Ghanaian flag went up and the British flag went down. We want them to experience what we experienced in Nigeria, what we experienced in Algeria, any place where we had independence. They need to see that Israeli flag come down and a Palestinian flag go up. We want that for them because we know what it feels like. As we said, we are them and they are us. So we want them to have that. And when Israel dies, Africa benefits, Palestine benefits, humanity benefits. Anytime a settler colony is put to rest, all peace-loving, truth-seeking, justice-seeking, liberation-seeking people benefit. The human race cleanses itself through this process when oppressive forces are put to rest. And they should not be the imperialist exception. If all other settler colonies died a violent death, or as Dr. King said, should die a spiritual death, why should they be the exception? Why should they be the only one maintained? It doesn't make any sense. So anything that we can do to create that atmosphere for that, for the plug to be pulled on the Zionist State of Israel, history obligates us to do that. And we just want to get it done quickly, and we want to take advantage. We are going to engage these mayors and engage these congresswomen and men. We're going to engage these legislators. Our whole community needs to be shown what these links are. And if this gives work in the Congo mileage through the Friends of the Congo, work in Haiti through the Socialists United to Save Haiti, because we want the organizations doing this work we want to bring light to their labor, because there are people who just come in, their commentary gets more of a boost, so to speak. But the organizations that are working every day, their labor is skipped over. Many, many decades ago, there was a documentary, y'all probably know about it, called Who Speaks for the Negro, as we were calling ourselves at that historical moment. We need a part two called Who Labors on Be Part of the African, because I think that people are confused about what labor is. So high-profile personalities taking trips and finally deciding to speak on something when it's convenient, that's not labor. Take the attention off these personalities. Matter of fact, let's shut down the valley of the brands and let's get back to movement fundamentalism, traditional organizing. And let's empower our organizations to maximize our potential. Let's encourage people who have a lot to say about everything to finally roll their sleeves up and be part of our organized resistance. I haven't struggled for 34 years to give birth to a bunch of individuals who have no respect for movement, no respect for struggle, no respect for resistance, to exploit the legacy of our greatest fighters and build their brands. So this is a call to action for everybody. So these people who all of a sudden out of nowhere are feeling that they have to speak out, they've just got to say something, we'll just stop them in the middle of their comments and say, if you're going to say something, that means you have to do something. And we will humbly point them in the direction of the labor. Because many of them don't like to sign on to work. Many of them don't like to connect their voices to the labor, to the struggle. So this is why we were so happy to have Ayanna Gregory's music, which she sent us. I've worked with Ayanna Gregory since 1990. To have Maimouna Youssef, a Grammy-nominated artist, sing live a Congolese song, as well as rebranding of Georgia On My Mind by Ray Charles. And I've talked to her. I'm going to talk to her tomorrow. I'm going to tell her how powerful that was. As many people don't know, it was shown in the Ray Charles movie, at least one part of it. Ray Charles is the first artist to refuse to play before a segregated audience. Isn't that right? But for $2 million, he went to South Africa / Zania under apartheid and performed with Frank Sinatra. And he didn't recognize the parallel between segregation and apartheid for whatever reason. Or he figured that he could benefit financially from apartheid. So to have Maimouna Youssef 45 years later make a song called Gaza On My Mind, that represents elevation, evolution, and we're just proud to have been part of that. Well, so the fight continues. We thank you, good brothers, for always giving us time, and as usual, we always bring people to your shows that are fighting with us.
Make sure that you forward me that proclamation, and we're going to make sure it gets out to at least the people that have been on the program and a lot of our contacts. Well,
every guest you've ever had, you know we're going to do that. And they got to also support this campaign to get Asada Shakur. Let me tell people that campaign, because I don't think I've ever talked about it. I haven't been on to talk about it. We started that in October. Number one, the great Asada Shakur must come off the terrorist list of that the Obama administration put him on before he took his high-profile field trip to Cuba. There's a $2 million bounty on her head. This is going back to Old West tradition. So Asada Shakur to them is like Doc Holliday or Billy the Kid or Jesse James or Frank James or the Dalton Gang. What the hell is wrong with these people? But character assassination creates the climate for a physical assassination. So even though you can't go to Cuba, they're saying if you would like, you can sneak over there and take a shot at her if you happen to see her. That's considered heroic. And then the third part of that
is, because we can't hear you. I'm going to have to. Go ahead. Wind it up.
Can you hear me?
I hear you now, but we're getting a lot of interference. I know you got family.
There's some wind outside, but no, what I said was, number one, Asada Shakur must come off to see what United States, the FBI's terrorist list. There's a $2 million bounty on her head, so even though they say Cuba's a forbidden area, but if you'd like to go there and make an attempt on her life, this is encouraged. That's how ridiculous that is. And then we want Cuba to come off the United States Department's list of countries they falsely accuse of state-sponsored terrorism. They must be mistaken in Cuba for Israel. So we also want people to sign on to that. And that's the interesting thing. I'm glad that you played our brother Coates talking, because he's affiliated with the Wakanda project. And we're saying that the time has come to evacuate Wakanda and get involved in a real fight for a real Panther. And nobody represents Black Panther tradition more than Asada Shakur does. So you can either wage cultural warfare or you can indulge in cultural escapism. And we approached the choreographer and who did the dancing and drumming choreography for Wakanda, and we told him to put it in the hands of this cast. And he said he doesn't present things to them politically. This was his response. But we know him. We know through circles. So we're not going to antagonize him. We're just going to keep pushing him through love, through patience, because he's never really been involved in real political struggle. And it goes back to what Paul Robeson said, the artist must elect to fight for freedom or captivity. But some of our artists think you can enjoy both. Or depending on what day of the week you see them, that's what they're fighting for. So, and this is where we're saying that Black excellence has a militant twin called African resistance. We embrace one twin and we run like hell from the other one. So the time has come to transform the island of Black excellence into a training ground for African resistance. And when we do that, Zionist Israel will meet stiffer resistance from us than it's ever had. All layers of imperialism will. So we our activity will have more clarity, more substance, more dimension. So one unified socialist Africa, one unified liberated Palestine, one unified, liberated planet Earth. Thank you so much for the opportunity this evening, my brothers.
Hello, Obi. Thanks for your work, and we'll be talking.
Thank you, yes, sir.
Peace. Richard?
Yes, yes.
Interesting dialogue tonight, not only to kind of encapsulate the work of Brother Obi, because he's always... I mean, he's in constant motion, but to hear from the young people on the college campuses and what they're doing, and the clarity of how they see of how they see what's going on, Richard. You know, it don't surprise me really, because it's a lot of intelligence among our people that you don't hear that much about. You hear a lot about the. Young people that they're cultivating to kind of take to carry the banner of American imperialism, and that's what they consider Black excellence. But tonight we heard Black excellence, the clarity of these issues, to be able to express them, to call a spade, so to speak. You know, these are the necessary things, and organizing is always the key. Go ahead, Richard.
Oh, no, I agree. I agree.
Yeah, I just want to make mention of that. It was good to hear from the young activists on these campuses, and I'm quite sure that we'll be hearing from more moving forward. Looking forward to some of the upcoming shows. Programs, I'm sorry. still on the 24th, we got Dr. Cornel West confirmed. So we'll be moving towards that. And before we go tonight, just want to give the lineup on time for an Awakening Media, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. African Perspectives with Brother Oshie, always interesting topics and dialogue on African Perspectives. That's Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Later on in the week, Mississippi on the Move, the Black Liberation Movement in Mississippi. Brother Patrick Lumumba as host, along with Sister Crystal Denise, Brother Rodney Lowe, Brother Dovesack, and sometimes several guest hosts. It's always interesting to hear some of the topics down there and exactly what they're doing as far as organizing. That's just more of an outreach on what Brother Obi was talking about tonight about the organizing.
There you go. Critical.
Exactly. Fridays, Time for Awakening is back from 8 until on Saturdays from 7 to 9, the Elders of Sankofa with Dr. Janine James as host. And then Sundays from 7 until Time for an Awakening is here. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program tonight. A lively discussion, as always, and we'll be back on Sunday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, or you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children. Soon it will be their turn to try and save the world. Right now they seem to play such a small part of.
To save the children.